There is literally no good news coming from the war in Gaza. More civilians have been killed there since October 7th of 2023 than in any conflict since the Second World War. The stated Israeli goal, of course, is to destroy Hamas. Most observers, including senior Israeli political and military leaders, acknowledge that that's impossible. Hamas members don't carry around identification cards, after all. What began for most Israelis as a righteous war to protect themselves and to free their hostages has become mired in accusations of genocide and murder, of starvation and displacement. And now it threatens the very political future of Benjamin Netanyahu, the longest-serving prime minister in Israel's history. I'm John Kiriakou. Welcome to The Whistleblowers. United Nations officials, humanitarian organizations, and journalists on the ground have described Gaza as hell on earth. There's no clean water. There isn't a single working hospital. The area is on the brink of widespread starvation. And more than a million people, half of the population, are internally displaced. Peace talks between the Israeli government and Hamas come in fits and starts, but they never really seem to amount to anything. And many Israelis, for a long time, could not understand why an Israeli government that in the past has been willing to trade 500 or even 1,000 Palestinian prisoners for one single Israeli hostage was this time willing to just let its hostages sit in limbo in Hamas's hands. And at the same time, reports have leaked out of Israel of atrocities against Palestinian prisoners in Israeli prisons. They are deliberately starved, for example. There's no medical care. They're not even permitted to walk and instead have to crawl everywhere on their hands and knees, and many are beaten mercilessly. Now we're learning that the situation may even be worse, much worse. The Israeli media, led by the newspaper Haaretz, have recently confirmed that the Israeli military had deployed its so-called Hannibal Directive, which allows the military to use what it calls all necessary force to prevent the capture of soldiers, even if that force results in the deaths of civilians, including Israeli civilians, which means hostages. The directive has been around for almost 20 years, but until recently, it was a closely guarded secret. Now that the information is out there for all to see, it has led to a debate over whether the Israeli army is actually trying to free hostages or merely to kill more Palestinians. Our guest today is the esteemed journalist Richard Silverstein. He writes for Tikkun Olam, the foremost blog covering Israeli national security issues. He is also a contributor to the Middle East Eye, Jacobin Magazine, The New Arab, and Al Jazeera. His work also has appeared in the New York Times. Richard, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, John. Great to be here.
I'd like to begin with something of a broad question, Richard. What makes this war different from any other war that Israel has fought against a non-state actor? There have been difficult, years-long wars against Hezbollah, for example. Why is this one so much more difficult, and why is it so much more violent?
This war started, this particular aspect of the ongoing decades-long war between Israel and Palestinians started with a Hamas attack on Israel on October 7th that was devastating, that punctured all the myths of Israeli invincibility, that broke through billions of dollars worth of surveillance technology designed to prevent just such an attack, resulted in the killing of 1,100 Israelis, 400 of whom were security agents and IDF soldiers. This had never happened to Israel before in this kind of fashion. So it was this surprise attack carried out in broad daylight, actually, after the fact. Israel discovered that several of its intelligence operatives had warned their superiors that Hamas was planning this, and their warning was ignored. So as a result of this shocking and heinous blow to the Israeli psyche, the government decided that they had to react in a massive fashion, one that had no proportion in terms of the damage it did, the actual damage it did to Israel. And that resulted in the genocide that we're finding here, in which we're at close to 40,000 Gazans murdered. And it explains why the Israeli response is so different than all the previous invasions of Lebanon and attacks on Gaza and similar kinds of operations in the past.
Tell us what's happening inside the Israeli government. This is the most right-wing government in Israeli history. And indeed, several ministers have previous criminal convictions for anti-Arab hate crimes. And for the most part, these are the ministers who are in charge of security. Is it these ministers who are influencing Prime Minister Netanyahu on the conduct of the war? Is it Israeli public opinion that's guiding policy? Or did Netanyahu need no outside pressure to launch a war that has focused so heavily on civilians and has been accused by the International Court of Justice of genocide?
In answer to your first question, I think that Itamar Ben-Gvir, who's the police minister, and one of those that you mentioned who had been convicted, I believe, 8 times on 8 different instances of anti-Arab incitement, and Bezalel Smotrich, who actually, as a minister, controls all of the settlement activity on the West Bank, and who, when he was younger, was arrested by the Shin Bet and found with an explosive device in his car. This was during the withdrawal from Gaza in 2004, I believe, by Israel. And he planned to detonate this explosive device on the Ayalon Highway, which is the major highway in Tel Aviv. He was arrested and held for 3 weeks and refused to answer his interrogators, and he was eventually released. So you have two really, I call them Israeli Jewish terrorists, and they're running the security operation in Israel. And this is why the Israeli police have become so vicious, not just to Palestinians, who, of course, they've always been vicious to, but they're attacking protesters, they're attacking the families of the hostages who are protesting against the lack of a ceasefire and Netanyahu's refusal to agree to a ceasefire. So they're using whips, police on horses with whips, and they're whipping the protesters. So this is violence, mass violence unleashed by the Israeli state against the Israeli citizens themselves. I think that the government is impermeable to political grassroots action. There have been, before the war started, there were weekly rallies of hundreds of thousands of Israelis opposed to the government, Israelis who were accusing the prime minister of being corrupt, and he faces four indicted on 4 charges of corruption, and that haven't been adjudicated. And there's no reason that Netanyahu has to pay attention to this or did pay attention to this. The only constituency that he has is Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, because they control his coalition. If they withdraw, they resign from the coalition, there's no government, and Netanyahu has to go to elections, and he will be vulnerable to the court cases, which are, for some reason, it's not been phrased this way, but they seem to have been put in abeyance while he is prime minister. So the war itself is critical to him remaining as prime minister. With no war, we revert to status quo ante and go back to the kinds of protests and unrest that happened before 10/7. And he is, this is the reason why he refuses to read a ceasefire. It's the reason why he's given the hostages short shrift, which is unforgivable and also unprecedented in Israeli history, for a leader of the government to have no concern for the hostages. Of course, he mouths concern, but he does nothing. And refuses every opportunity to negotiate a ceasefire. And by the way, President Biden announced a week or two ago with fanfare that Hamas had softened its demands and that there was now a new promising basis for a ceasefire. And as soon as that happened, Netanyahu announced five new demands that Hamas could never agree to, and this, in effect, has sabotaged and killed the latest attempt at ceasefire.
Richard, let's talk about the Hannibal Directive. This is a story that you broke. This came out of the 1986 war against Hezbollah and was formally implemented about 20 years ago. It has been a secret until recently, and the bottom line is that it significantly changes the way the public sees the government's commitment to Israeli hostages. So actually, let's start with that. Is the Israeli government still committed to rescuing hostages, or is the prime directive now to not be taken prisoner and to just kill Palestinian combatants, even if it means killing Israeli hostages?
Well, let's talk about the Hannibal Directive and give some background. What it entails is a policy that the IDF follows in wartime. This is how it originated. Follows in wartime to prevent IDF soldiers from being captured by Hamas. And this, I started reporting this 10 years ago during Operation Protective Edge, which was in 2014. And that use of the invoking of the Hannibal Doctrine actually ended up killing two IDF soldiers who were being carried back to Gaza, or carrying away from their units and into captivity. The IDF not only killed the two soldiers, but it destroyed the neighborhood of Shujaya, which is where the hostages were about, or the captives were about to be taken. Literally mass destruction, and the entire neighborhood was destroyed. And this is similar to what happened in Nusayrat about 2 weeks ago, when the Israel, when the IDF mounted a rescue operation there and freed four of the hostages. In order to do that and to prevent Hamas from initiating a counterattack, which they were doing to stop the rescue, they basically went in and carpet bombed the neighborhood, and they killed nearly 300 Palestinian civilians in the process, and succeeded in releasing or freeing four of those hostages. Hannibal is heinous on its face, because it's the one of the first episodes, one of the first pieces of evidence I've seen of the military of the country willingly and intentionally murdering its own soldiers. That was 2014. Now, bringing us up to date to 2024, on October 7th, actually, 2023, the war has gone on for 9 months, so time flies. But in on October 7th, they expanded Hannibal, and they said that we are going to invoke it to kill Israeli civilians. These were civilians who were being sped in jeeps back towards Gaza after being captured in Israel during the invasion by Hamas. These were soldiers who had been captured on their bases in southern Israel and were being taken back. These were, in another instance, an IDF general commanded a tank to fire a shell point blank into a home in a kibbutz where they knew there were hostages, Israeli civilians, along with Hamas fighters. And instead of negotiating or trying to figure out a way to free the Israelis, they actually killed them.
Thank you, Richard. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Richard Silverstein, and we'll discuss new reports that the Palestinian death toll may be astronomically higher than what has been previously reported. Stay tuned. We have a lot more coming up.
Welcome to LA. Welcome to Dreamland, where dreams come true.
We have approximately 10 million people in California that are at risk of becoming unhoused.
Looks good, man.
You want some?
Some people are working two, three jobs and still not enough, because the cost of living also has increased.
Because of COVID and Joe Biden.
Just last year alone, the amount of homeless rose by 12% in California.
Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We're speaking with journalist Richard Silverstein. He writes for Tikkun Olam, the foremost blog covering Israeli national security issues. He's also a contributor to the Middle East Eye, Jacobin Magazine, The New Arab, and Al Jazeera, and his work also has appeared in The New York Times. Richard, thanks again for being with us.
Great to be here, John. Thanks again.
The pleasure's mine, Richard. Let's talk about the Gaza death toll and about a recent piece in The Lancet. Now, The Lancet is the preeminent British medical journal. As of June 19th, 2024, the Gaza Ministry of Health had determined that 37,396 Palestinians had been killed in Gaza. The Israeli military confirmed that the ministry's numbers were likely correct. The ministry further estimated that at least another 10,000 people were likely buried under the rubble. But the Lancet article goes on to say that the actual number of dead could be much, much higher, as high as 186,000 people. Can you explain that to us?
Well, the Lancet publication, and as you said, the Lancet does not publish reports like this, willy-nilly. It has a lot of data that it uses and is very conservative in these sorts of situations in which there's a lot of contention. There's a lot of disinformation, especially on the Israeli side, to discredit the health ministry figures. But the reason that it suggested that it could be 186,000 is that it's not just the 30, by the way, it's the latest figures are closer to 38,000, more than 38,000. But it's not just the 38,000. Those are the ones we know are dead. We have nearly half of the buildings in Gaza are destroyed. That's not just homes. That includes schools, universities, power plants, UNRWA facilities, the United Nations Relief Organization. The entire landscape of Gaza is a ruin. Underneath all of those ruins are thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of bodies. There is no excavation machinery in Gaza that can, like in the case of earthquakes, where you can bring in massive excavators and whatever and dig through buildings and look for bodies. And you have the dogs who can sniff out the corpses and try to to free them from the rubble. So there's a huge number of people that have their deaths haven't been counted. In addition, you have impacts that are not direct. For example, people will die of disease after the conflict. They'll die of starvation after the conflict. They'll die from medical neglect because, as I think you know, all the hospitals have been destroyed in Gaza. So without medical treatment, you may not die now, but you will die later of the implications that the causes of that brought you to need the medical care in the first place. So the key factor here in coming to that number is they've compared Gaza to other similar conflicts. And they've said that for each known victim who's died, there are somewhere between 3 and 5 people who have died that they do not know about yet, won't know about until well after the conflict ends. So if you do the multiplication there, you come up with nearly 40,000 times 3 or 5, you're getting up to the 186,000 figure. And this puts the genocide, and I use that term very deliberately, and I think we're going to talk about that in a second. This genocide puts it in the arena of the genocide in Rwanda and the genocide in East Timor. And it actually is greater than many of the really well-known genocides like in Bosnia. So we're talking about an unprecedented historic event in which no one, no global, no criminal or legal system such as the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice, none of them, even though they've attempted to address the genocide, none of them has been able to have any impact on Israel. And the reason why is that Israel's allies, especially in the United States, but many European countries, support the Israel, support what it's doing, and do so with $18 billion in the case of the U.S. Congress. $18 billion in weapons have been sent to Israel since October 7th. So that's the reason why there is no rules-based order, despite what everybody likes to call it. That's the reason why the humanitarian effort has failed. There basically is hardly any humanitarian effort in Gaza because Israel has prohibited it by killing many of the aid workers. In addition to killing the journalists themselves who are reporting on this, there's 125 journalists who have been murdered. And I use the term murder because they're deliberately targeting not only the journalists themselves, but in some cases, the families of the journalists. The Al Jazeera correspondent in Gaza, not only did he die, but his wife was murdered. And this was done intentionally as a warning to Gazans and to journalists that Israel does not want this reported. The only journalists who, aside from the Gazans who are stringers for various media, who can go into Gaza, the only foreign journalists who go into Gaza have to go in with the IDF. They have to be embedded with the IDF. And this skews the coverage that you'll see in world media. You will mostly be getting the Israeli point of view. And that really is another factor that renders it impossible for the outside world to have much impact to stop this or to mount a powerful protest that will lead to the end of this madness.
Well, as you've so correctly noted, so many of these deaths are a result of disease, thirst, starvation, and an utter lack of medical care, even for injuries. And failing to count these deaths is actually a violation of international law. The International Court of Justice in January of 2024 required Israel to, quote, take effective measures to prevent the destruction and ensure the preservation of evidence related to allegations of acts within the scope of the Genocide Convention, unquote. Has Israel done that? And if yes, why are the death numbers so far off?
Israel has ignored every outside factor in attempting to exert some control or hold Israel accountable. I've just mentioned the International Criminal Court, and the chief prosecutor several months ago announced that he was going to ask a judicial panel of the ICC to issue arrest warrants for Bibi Netanyahu and Yoav Gallant, the defense minister. However, the panel has not announced any decision. So Israel, by the way, has screamed bloody murder about these global judicial forums and attacked them, attacked anyone inside Israel or the Palestinians who collaborate with these UN bodies and treated them as terrorists or enemies of the state, including, by the way, Israeli human rights NGOs have been smeared and targeted as well with not just verbal attacks, but physical attacks as well. So Israel has been able to completely ignore these and just acts with impunity. It certainly is pursuing and continuing the genocide. The death toll continues to mount, despite the fact that Israel claims that it's trying to or is separating civilians from Hamas fighters. That's actually a lie, and I don't think that anyone in the world believes it. But it's not helped by the fact that you have State Department spokespeople and the U.S. Secretary of State who ignore this, who when the word genocide is mentioned to them, they bristle and they claim that it isn't genocide, it can't be genocide. It's as if the U.S. government is issuing Israeli talking points and speaking as if it is Israel itself. And this is really anathema to the American people. 60% of the American people disapprove not only of Israel's genocide in Gaza, but they disapprove of Biden's policy and approach towards it. But they will not negotiate a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. They will not accept a two-state solution. So anyone, especially someone like President Biden and Antony Blinken, who believes that they want the opposition in power because they might be able to achieve their goals of a two-state solution, if they're really serious about that, which is another question, I don't think there will be any major change. And the same thing holds true, by the way. The U.S. policy won't change very much in Gaza or elsewhere. There'll be continuity, and the things that we would like to see changed in U.S. foreign policy will not change. The things that we might want to see change in domestic policy regarding immigration and such issues, those won't change either. But in Israel, it's even more critical because you have the capacity of a regional war. Israel is on the verge, perhaps, of invading Lebanon and going to war against Hezbollah. And if they do, Iran has promised to enter on the side of Hezbollah. So you have this situation like, just before World War I, where gradually all the major powers in the region have been drawn into one side or the other of a conflict. So you have Israel's enemies, the axis of resistance, it's called, include Iran and Hezbollah and the Houthis and Iraqi Shiite militia and Syria, by the way. And so all of them could be entering the conflict on behalf of Hezbollah, and you'll have Israel and the U.S. and its allies. So this is an extremely volatile situation, extremely dangerous situation, and we have to really really work hard to restore some sanity to the situation, even though it doesn't seem that's possible right now. But we have to do as much as we can to stand in the way of this juggernaut of hatred and destruction.
Richard, thank you so much for joining us. It's a pleasure. Genocide is a tough word. What distinguishes genocide from murder and even from acts of political violence that claims as many victims is the intent. Genocide is the desire to make a people extinct. The idea of genocide is a crime. Nelson Mandela warned the world years ago to not look the other way. It is within all of us to prevent genocide from happening. I'd like to thank our guest, Richard Silverstein, for being with us today. And thank you to our viewers for joining us for another episode of The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. Please follow me on Substack @ John Kiriakou. We'll see you next time.